we're looking at well-being. And for me, if I think about what that looks like, it's about being able to have the increasing and expanding capacity for gratitude and awe and joy and love in our everyday living. And that's why, working with broken attachment bonds and trauma, that interferes with our capacity to do that. So if we can nourish our nervous systems and nurture our nervous systems by doing that work, then we are increasing and expanding our capacity for these wonderful things in our lives.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Today, we welcome along Jennifer Rodriguez, who I met whilst training as a sensory motor psychotherapist. I'm really delighted to have Jennifer here. Jennifer is an attachment-based psychotherapist specialising in attachment-related issues and trauma. She holds a special interest in how the quality of our earliest attachments impacts on our health, social and mental well-being, and in the neuroscience, neurobiology, ethology, phylogeny, and how it shows up in the betweeners in the therapeutic space. And don't worry, Jennifer's going to explain what phylogeny means during the course of
you
this
shouldn't
conversation.
Have tried it twice.
No, it was a bit ambitious, wasn't it? Jennifer believes that there's a sacred primal wisdom in the body, mostly forgotten now in our fast-paced Western civilization, and in the wholeness of the mind, body, spirit, and what it means to be human. As when Mother Nature designs things that work, she then replicates it everywhere. Jennifer believes that we are a species that thrives not only in connection to ourselves, but to every living being, creature on Earth, as well as being of the Earth and of being part of a greater intelligence beyond our capacity to understand it right now. Jennifer was educated, worked and lived in Trinidad, the UK, the US and France, which ignited her interest in the ties of culture and nationhood, multicultural perspectives and experiences. Alongside this, and with over 30 years of international, commercial and corporate experience of advising senior professionals in their organisations, Jennifer is experienced in coaching individuals to improve their leadership skills. And Jennifer, you began your career as a chartered civil engineer working across the UK construction industry. So an absolute breadth and depth of experience that you bring into this conversation today. Really pleased to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Naomi and David, for inviting me to speak here in your forum of Locked Up Living about my work with people who have experienced trauma. Now, may I remember when we first talked about this, we were both talking about how interested we were in well-being and the role of attachment theory and trauma and what the role that plays in this and how we might be able to generate this for and within ourselves and for our community. So it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Hello, Jennifer. Really lovely to meet you. So you've had a really fascinating and rich career, including working with traumatized people over many years. Can you describe your career pathway for us?
Sure. So this is my third career, and I believe I'm a relative novice or newcomer to the field for someone of my age. It was back in 2005, about there, when I was first sitting when I had my first what I call in the room awareness of sitting with someone who was in their early 30s experiencing fugue states. Fugue states is, I had never come across that before. I was just starting my training as a therapist. And in fact, none of the people in my group or even my supervision group knew what that was. But it's where you physically are with someone but they're really not there. And my experience of sitting with someone was of being voiceless, pinned into the chair and in the place where I was really lost to myself. And in seeking answers to this and what that was, led me to find Alan Shaw's work and then to train at the Bowlby Center. So as I said, I was interested. I found Alan Shaw's work, and Dr. Alan Shaw he's an American psychologist and researcher in the field of neuropsychology, and he's considered an authority on modern attachment. sort of like a neurobiological update of John Bowlby's work. And his work and his interest leans heavily on the neuroscience of attachment and everything else around that. So the animal behavior, which is the ethology, the evolutionary biology and phylogeny, which is, so phylogeny, as we were talking about it earlier, is actually the evolutionary history of the species and the evolutionary relationships of species. And his work and my work, my interest also took into account mother infant dyads. So I embarked on this training at the Bowlby Center in 2008. And since then I've expanded my understanding of attachment and trauma, how it happens, how to work with clients experiencing it. Alongside this expanding understanding has also been my evolving understanding of what the role of therapy for me, what the purpose and the role of therapy is for me. You've introduced the word trauma, and perhaps I thought it would be a good idea just to sort of give a definition of how I understand it. And the easiest and simplest definition that I like is by someone called Peter Levine, who is a founder and pioneer of somatic experiencing. He's well known for his work in the trauma field. So his definition is that trauma is not what happens to you, but it's what happens inside of you as a result of what happens to you. And here's the interesting part, in the absence of an empathic presence or an empathic present person. So to some extent, we're all of us not without some sort of relational or developmental trauma, because none of us experienced 100% perfect parenting or, schooling where we had access to that sort of support. And the interesting thing about trauma is that it leaves residues in the nervous system. So it leads us to disconnect from ourselves because it was too painful, too overwhelming for us to be able to feel. So, whilst I was interested in what was happening with my client, I really got a sort of a really good introduction, if you like, to the world of trauma and the role that attachment plays in that. And then following my training at the Bowlby Center, I felt I needed to have some support, if you like, in the application of working with people who've experienced trauma. I went on to train in something called energy psychotherapy and sensory motor psychotherapy, and both of those are body-based modalities. And then more recently, I've been engaging with Stephen Porges's polyvagal theory, and there's something called a safe and sound protocol, and also Gabor Mate's compassionate inquiry. So it's an ongoing sort of journey of training for me.
Can I just clarify with you what you mean by body-based modality?
That's a really good question. The training that I received at the Bowlby Center is psychoanalytic psychotherapy. It's psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And that a lot of that is about talking. It's quite cognitive. And the issue, earlier I said that trauma leaves a residue in the nervous system. The nervous system is our body. And so when working with trauma, you really need to bring the body into conversation. And sometimes there really aren't very many words, not cognitive words for sure. And a lot of the times they're not even memories of, things that someone might have experienced. So there are quite a few body-based modalities, of which, Peter Levine's somatic experiencing is another one. So that's what I meant, where you work with the body and through the body. It's not like massage or something like that, though. It's where you help the person, the client, into a state where they can observe and notice and access you know, their body, and they can actually, and then through that, through a series of interventions, they can get to various unconscious aspects of pain.
That's helpful, but I am a bit ignorant in this particular area, so I'm struggling to kind of bring form to the concepts that you're describing. So is it a bit like bioenergetics, say?
You know, I don't know what bioenergetics are, but would you like to try an experiment, David?
I could try an experiment, yes.
So, you know, as you're talking right now, and we're engaging in this conversation, is it possible for you just to notice, if you just go into your body and just notice, for example, where there's any constriction or tension, any sort of expansion or spaciousness in your body?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can do that.
And then, can you bring your attention maybe to your feet and the support it's receiving from the floor?
Okay, yeah, I can feel that. My feet were feeling a bit tense a moment ago.
And how does it feel then to have them being supported by the floor?
Yeah, it's good to have the support of the floor there. That's a good feeling.
And what about, you know, you're sitting on a chair, are you?
I am, yes.
And can you feel the support of the weight of your body from the chair? So you've got the support of the floor, the support from the chair. Can you notice that?
Yes. Yeah, I can notice the support in my back, to my elbows.
Mm-hmm. And even as I asked you to do that, I noticed you sort of literally sat back and straightened up a little bit. And, you know, when you sort of feel that support from the floor and the chair, what do you notice happens in your body?
Well, my body becomes much more aware of itself and prepared to shift to more comfortable. It notices the tension and the discomfort.
And has that gotten bigger or smaller or say the same?
Pretty much may stay the same, yes.
So that's an example of working with the body. And, you know, from working with different parts of the spaciousness, the tension, the constriction, and so on, we have access to unconscious experiences, pain, and then we can work with that. Does that make sense?
That's very helpful. Yes, thanks a lot, Jennifer. Can I ask for another point of clarification?
Sure.
About your definition of trauma. I think what I heard, or at least what I understood, was you saying that trauma is a kind of event, an internal event, or perhaps an internal effect that's unmediated, unmanaged by a benign presence. Is that what you meant?
I think it's more than that. It's essentially what happens inside of us when we experience an event outside of us that is overwhelming. So that could happen at any age. Now, of course, the older, you know, if you think of a baby, they need a lot of regulation and support because they don't have a lot of capacity to regulate themselves. Whereas maybe a child of five has more capacity than a baby, and an adolescent of 12 has more capacity than a child of five. And finally, an adult of 25 or 30 will have more capacity to regulate themselves than, say, the baby. So it's more about the capacity to regulate ourselves. If we experience an event that is overwhelming, so in other words, we're not regulating ourselves, if there isn't another empathic adult around who can help us, then there's a possibility for trauma to be happening inside the body, specifically within the nervous system. It's all about the nervous system. Everything is in the nervous system regulates everything in the body. So it's all about the nervous system, which includes the brain and the cerebral and the spinal nerves and so on.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Sorry, Naomi.
I was just going to say that I think that's really interesting. People often wonder why, you know, some people might have an adverse reaction to an event where somebody else might experience the same thing and not have that adverse reaction.
Absolutely.
I think that definition kind of clarifies why two people might have very different, you know, there might be consequences for one person and not another. But it also brought to mind for me, in thinking about the importance of the empathic witness, of how systems can be traumatizing, and often in systems, you know, people may be subjected to event, like for instance being forcibly medicated.
Absolutely.
And experience that as traumatizing, and how much more we can do as staff or as part of the system to mitigate those effects by acknowledging the impact of things like forced medication or restraint in the prison system, for instance, rather than denying the impact or avoiding the impact, that we each have the potential to do more for our clients by thinking about how we engage with them about these aspects of the system that might feel necessary at the time but still have the potential to be damaging.
I think that's absolutely correct, Naomi. And, you know, it's interesting that you brought up some of the medical procedures and you were talking about, you know, prison systems. I remember about maybe, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, I had to undergo a procedure in a hospital. And the only thing I remember is the nurse holding my hand. And even as I talk about it, I can almost feel a little, you know, a little grief there, and how wonderful it was to have somebody hold my hand whilst, because she knew obviously the procedure was very invasive, shall we say. So yeah, I mean, there's and I do, you know, that there is a lot more that we can do with our institutions and within society, whether it's at schools or the medical establishment and how, you know, hospitals and, you know, things like the criminal justice system, as you were talking about, and how we could, you know, have them, you know, be much more attachment informed and trauma informed.
Thank you. So Jennifer, you did spend many years working at the John Bowlby Centre. Can you tell us something about your work there and why Bowlby's work is still so relevant?
So I think, can I start with a little bit about Bowlby and then I will talk a little bit about my work there? Would that be helpful? Because maybe a lot of people don't even know about attachment or who John Bowlby is.
Right.
So John Bowlby was a British psychologist, psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, notable for his interest in child development. And together with Mary Ainsworth, they led the pioneering work in attachment theory. And attachment theory holds that we as human beings are born with the inherent capacity for making emotional bonds, becoming attached to those who care for us in our childhood. And by the way, it's not only human animals, if you like. I mean, you see this a lot with other mammals, for example. But I believe that it takes, you know, the human infant takes the longest to actually mature. Whereas a lot of other mammals, maybe they have shorter periods for maturing. And whilst that human infant is maturing, we need that attachment or that bond to a caregiver. So, and we become attached to those caregivers. Our attachment to others continues throughout our lives. And if we have enough of our early attachment needs met, we are then enabled to explore the world with confidence and with well-being, and trusting that we have a safe haven to return to when the going gets tough. We learn what to expect in the way of behavior from others and the likely consequences of how we feel, think, and act. And at the time when he was doing his research, which had been in the mid 1940s or something like that, some of the things that he was responsible for in terms of his work, before that, with psychoanalysis, it was all about the internal world. Freud kind of started to go along a certain route about the external things that people were experiencing, but he had to turn away from some of that. But Bowlby actually then, he really held true to the impact of the real life on the mother and the child. He talked about us developing what he calls internal working models of how our relationships work. He was interested in the early childhood patterns of those relationships and the role of safety in all of that. There was also another aspect of it where he didn't separate the mind and the body. So from my training at the Bowlby Center, we believe that most mental and physical illnesses and conditions have links to this early attachment environment we find ourselves. And in our adaptive strategies that are developed, they have a capacity. So when I talk about adaptive strategies, I'm talking about the adaptive patterns of how we learned to live within that environment. And when we talk about environment, we're really talking about the holding of the adults around us, whether it's a loving mother or a grandmother, it could be a teacher, but it's really, it's about people. It's not so much the physical environment. And how those experiences that we have help us to adapt, but those experiences then go on to impact our capacity for health and well-being into adulthood, for better and for worse. So in 2008 was when I did my training, and I finished up my training in 2013. And afterwards, I joined, I was a seminar lead, as they call them, which is essentially a teacher for the Infant Observation Seminar and a seminar called Perspectives on Trauma and Dissociation. And I was also a member of the Clinical Training Committee. And it was really my teaching and my interest. I was really drawn to infant observation. And I really had, you know, when you do a training, you learn so much so quickly that sometimes you don't have a lot of time to go in depth into anything. And, you know, I was really grateful to have that opportunity, particularly on the infant observation front, because it allowed me to deepen my understanding and learning around these subjects. And I was really drawn to infant observation. Now, maybe I should explain what that is as well, because I don't know how many adult therapy trainings actually do that.
But, very few, I imagine. Very few these days. Yeah. And practically no psychology trainings. Would I be right in saying that, Naomi?
Well, probably. Well, I mean, we do obviously do child placements, so you do get the opportunity to observe, but probably not in the systematic way that Jennifer's describing.
Yeah.
So, and that's one of the reasons why I was very interested to do the training there. As part of that training, you had to do, as a trainee, you had to find a mother and infant dyad. And you had to observe them in their natural environment, which is borrowed, that term is borrowed from mythology, over 18 months every week. Now, the goal was to try and find a mother-infant dyad where you would be observing a secure attachment in the making. And it can be very tricky because as a student, you don't really know what that looks like. And so one of my roles as the seminar lead was to work together with a trainee to vet whether there was a possibility of a secure attachment happening for a specific couple. And, you know, we would look at that together. I really loved working with the trainees as well. And I was hoping that they would fall in love with this area as much as I was. And it was so interesting to see what things they teased out of it, what they loved. And I really enjoyed reading their case studies. because at the end of the 18 months, they have to write a case study about their observations. And essentially that's a theoretical paper where they bring in aspects of all the various attachment teachers, if you like, and there are many. So that was one of the things that I really enjoyed about working at the Bowlby Centre.
I was just going to say that it's interesting that you raise the issue of infant observation. I did one in my psychotherapy training, and I really found it very valuable. But I also know I'd find it much more valuable if I were to do it now rather than then. Anyway.
So where did you train, David?
I trained at the London Centre for Psychotherapy, which is now a part of that broader organisation. I'm not sure of the name of it, even.
Why do you say it's more interesting now than then?
Oh, because I think when I did my training, I was relatively young, and I didn't know that much. And I think I know much more what kind of things to look for, how to pick up the sense of things rather than just the facts of things, and that kind of item.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But then I think that about most of my training, I should go back and do it again.
Yeah, I suppose they're at, that's a really interesting point, because, you know, my original training laid the foundations for things. But then as I've done other trainings, it's sort of almost like, you know, you do another pass at it and you either get an expanded view of something or you get an in-depth view, maybe you get both, you know. So all the time it's about building on it's like building blocks really on the foundations of your original training.
So you've told us about your work at the Bowlby Centre and your interest in attachment theory. Do you think attachment theory can have any relevance to how people, men particularly, I think, end up in the criminal justice system?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I personally do not have any experience of working with people who are in the criminal justice system. But I wonder, you know, it would be interesting to see how many people who say are in prison currently, if they did the adverse childhood experiences score. Do you know about ACE? Do you know that?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them, what scores they would have? Because, you know, that the adverse childhood experiences exercise really looks at the sorts of human environment that people were growing up in. So it looks at things like various kinds of abuse, physical, sexual, emotional, living with someone who's abusing drugs, losing a parent through divorce, living with someone with a serious mental, I mean, it goes on, but I mean, essentially it's kind of very attachment related. And I do believe that, you know, our early experiences do really tend to follow us into our adulthood. And in thinking about this question, I was wondering about, you know, if you think about crimes like murder and rape, substance abuse, and the trading that goes all around, you know, drugs and so on. At an individual level, it feels as if we're looking at things like dissociation, abuses of power, greed, violence, aggression, addictions. So where do these behaviors come from? You know, why a lot of those are around fear or pain. And, you know, when I think about it on an individual level, working with clients, where does fear and pain come from? It's really about dysregulation and lack of safety. So, you know, and it all then goes back to, you know, early attachment experiences.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think, Jennifer, that in the populations that David and I have worked with, the people that we encounter in prisons and psychiatric institutions are not people who are describing, you know, experiences of feeling safe and loved during childhood. That they're few and far between. Typically, what you hear is a lot of danger and abuse and neglect, and a lot of threat. And so you can see how people are ending up chronically dysregulated as a consequence of multiple breaches of their rights as a child to safety and love.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely.
And another theme of therapy that you've been discussing before it became fashionable, Jennifer, is the impact of transgenerational trauma. And I wondered if you could say a little bit about this concept. Because, you know, on this theme of people having histories of trauma and then ending up in secure institutions, obviously we know that people from racialized minority groups are overrepresented within psychiatric institutions, both in the health system and the prison system.
So, you know, when I talked earlier, I was actually talking about how trauma actually disrupts the nervous system, or it wires the nervous system in a certain way. And, you know, when we think about what that does is, you know, it sort of diminishes our capacity to be able to be there for somebody else. And already, you know, in the 1940s, Bowlby was talking about intergenerational transmission of attachment relations. And he was talking about helping parents as a means to helping their children. And it all starts with maternal deficits in maternal care. Again, back to this mother-infant dyad. So we know from research that a frightened or frightening caregiver is not emotionally available for her infant and child. And so some of my clients, for example, come into therapy looking for answers and support because they have been triggered by their child at age X. And one of the first places I want to look is, you know, what happened to you when you were aged X? You know, because if the infant is overwhelmed, and as I said, you know, when we were talking before, infants are very easily overwhelmed when they're born. They need a lot of care and support. They would die without care if they didn't get care. And if they're left in a state of overwhelm, that's when, you know, the body actually becomes quite dysregulated, where no one notices, no one comes. Or worse yet, the caregiver is the source of the overwhelm. In that case, the caregiver is the source of the abuse. That overwhelm is actually being wired into the nervous system. And if this happens repeatedly, there are gaps in when a child grows up to an adult, there are gaps in what the adult of that infant can actually, how that adult can actually navigate out in the world. I don't know if that makes sense. So then now that adult has a child, and when their child is in that specific state of overwhelm, they trigger the adult. There is really no adult brain, no cortex around. The adult is dysregulated and the child just goes with them. So that explains how something like intergenerational trauma can happen. And originally, it was just thought of as something that happened. It wasn't sort of an inheritable gene thing. But I believe that through epigenetics, they're also finding that experience that's passed on over generations can show up in things like how genes express themselves in the telomeres, for example, how, you know, proteins are actually produced and things like that. And of course, it's the marginalized peoples in their communities, you know, who sort of seem to be bearing the brunt of a lot of these mental and physical conditions and illnesses. So,
yeah, it's really fascinating stuff, isn't it? I think when you kind of like hear about the impact of things. I was reading about the experiments with mice where they'd administered shocks to the parents, but then the offspring it was paired with a light, and the offspring had never had that experience, but when they saw the light, they presented as frightened because they'd in some way that had been conveyed. So I think it's really interesting to it would be more interesting, I guess, to see what further emerges within this area.
Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the things, you know, that we've ended up having a bit of conversation about on the podcast is about how the majority of therapists working in secure institutions are white women, and what impact that therefore might have on the therapeutic space, especially when people are coming from backgrounds where they're not white, and the majority of people who are in the criminal justice system are obviously male. So wondering, you know, how that might affect therapy.
Okay. So I will answer that question in a little bit, because I just want to talk a little bit about some of my training and some of the work that I've done myself around trauma and the people of the Caribbean, because I spent quite a bit of time studying some of that when I was actually at the Bowlby Center. And there is a writer called Barbara Fletchman Smith. She's a psychotherapist in the UK, and she wrote two books, but one of them is called Transcending the Legacies of Slavery. And she makes a compelling argument for a lot of these sorts of things that we're talking about. You know, the circularity of persistent trauma of slavery for both the men and the women and the broken attachments. And she writes that the male slave's body and the female slave's body were not their own. And she writes of the disturbance in the coupling and the family relationships as a consequence of the structure of the slave plantations. And she also says, the biggest disaster, and this speaks to your question, David, the biggest disaster for Africans as a people was the diminution of power of the African father through the institution of slavery. And what I found when I read this, I was like, oh my God, because she went through the hierarchy that you might have in a typical slave plantation. So you had the white white European owner, or maybe an overseer, because maybe the owner wasn't there. And typically that person was a male, and that person had supreme power over everybody on a plantation. And they may have their wife, a European woman, and then they would typically also sleep with anybody that they wanted. And so then there was, you know, the slave women. And finally, there was the slave man. But because he had no power, to protect his family. So say, for example, he coupled with another slave woman. He had no power to control what happened to his child, no power to protect his family or his wife. So in other words, he lost almost all power. He was at the bottom of the pecking order. And when I was reading some of this stuff, it was just so scary. And also I could see it so much in the society where I grew up, which was in Trinidad. And it's across the board. It's not only just, say, in maybe the Black community or the Indian community. It is actually, there is an absence of father. There is a struggle for fathers to stand up and take their role in the way. At least this is my personal opinion. And there is also a very damaging aspect of for women, in that they have to be independent. They have to work now, you know, because work is their way of surviving. Now, if you think about all of those things, they all come from there back then, which was in the 14-somethings or the other. So now we go back to your question. I don't have any experience of working, as I said before, with people in prison. But as you rightly point out, in therapy, we, you know, certainly in my training, we talked about the power dynamic operating in therapy between the therapist and the client. And I need to qualify that this is really my thoughts on it. But you know, if you were trying to do that work, you really need to understand about the person that you're working with. You know, You know, what have they and their families experienced with institutions and services? And how does this contribute to their distrust of authority, for example? How is that continuing to play out in their beliefs and their own capacity for agency? And on the other side, you know, if therapists are working in these areas, they really need to have done their work. And it's not just general work, it's quite specific. You know, what is their history? What is their ancestral history? What is their motivation for helping in a specific environment? What is their awareness, their real awareness, and what can they bring? You know, how do they do that? You know, I was recently at a workshop where somebody called Kenneth Hardy was talking. He's a guest speaker and he specializes in, you know, racialized selves and diversity and so on. And he asks many of his clients, at what age did you begin to think about yourself racially? And what he finds is that for Black people, so he's an American. So what he finds is that for Black people, it usually starts around the age of 3 or 4. For white people, he finds it could be at age 20, 30, and much older. For me, growing up in Trinidad, it was about 10. I was 10 years. In fact, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was 10 years old. So, and I have done a bit of work on myself around intercultural therapy and things like that. But you do have to do the work. You have to do your own work. And then, of course, there's always the ubiquitous role of shame, because there's going to be shame on all sides. So, yeah.
Thank you. I think that's really thought-provoking, because I think too often people find themselves practicing as therapists without having, in fact, I think that's probably, it's psychologists that are probably most guilty of that, because I think most other forms of therapy would insist on, or most schools of therapy would insist on people experiencing therapy as a condition of that, whereas counselling psychology does require the individuals in training to have therapy, but clinical psychology, forensic psychology, they don't require that at all. So it's perfectly possible for somebody to be in a therapeutic role without having ever been on the receiving end of having therapy for them. For themselves. And I think you've just given a great example of why it's so important, you know, for very many reasons, but you know, that was a really good reason why people should.
There's just one more thing I want to say. I've been reading Rezma Menekim, and okay, it's quite a difficult read actually, but he writes about how non-white groups learn to protect themselves, especially in the proximity and contact with white groups, and the subtle dynamic where non-white people have to behave in ways that do not trigger fear in white people. And I remember, you know, I kind of, you know, it's something that I knew, and I guess I knew that because I grew up in Trinidad. And it was an, oh my God, for me, it was an oh my God moment, because I realized that's so true. And I was not even aware of it. And, you know, so it's not only about doing your work, but you have, if you're going to be working with certain populations, you really need to engage with yourself and what overlaps you might have with their traumas. And you need to also understand, you know, the history of, you know, what their traumas are, whether it's war, whether it's immigration, you know, all of those different things, they do impact, you know, why, you know, the pain that people carry and the suffering, and hence the work.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure. But relating to that last question, Jennifer, I wondered whether you thought that it was possible or right for white people, white therapists, to be working with people of colour?
Gosh, that's a tricky question.
Well, I ask it because it's something similar has cropped up in several of the conversations that we've had, and a few moments ago when you were asking about when an individual begins to think of themselves in a racialized sort of way. Because I have a great-great-grandmother, I think, who was Indian. So I have some Indian in
ancestry.
Me.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know that until quite late in life. It's never impinged upon my life in any way that I've been able to discern. I've always been, in my mind, a white person. And so I haven't suffered any of the difficulties or the traumas that you've alluded to. But I don't know if I'm at all equipped, really, to work with people who have been through those particular experience. That's the reason I was asking the question.
The fact that you are aware of that and you question it is probably makes you a good person to be able to work with those people, because you are aware of it and you're holding it in mind when you're working with it, and you're keeping it within yourself, and that, you know, it's much, much worse for the people who are just like so unaware. That's what I think, but I can't say categorically, you know, you shouldn't. I do believe that it shouldn't matter if you have done your work as a therapist. If you know, like you said, your great-great-grandmother, and I don't know whether she had trauma or not. I don't know what was going on in India at the time, and I don't know your history. But the fact that you know that tells me that you've looked into it, at least, and you understand some of that.
It just reminds me a little bit of the question about, you know, services that sprung up where for female survivors of sexual abuse where only female therapists are in operation. And I suppose what that does is confirms the idea that men are dangerous. So actually, if you've been sexually abused by a man, in some ways you may get more therapeutic gain from working with a man who's aware of the dynamics and is able to help you process that. Because actually, if you're going to therapy as a survivor of sexually abused by a man and you're working with a female, maybe you get validation, but you don't actually perhaps get to challenge the idea that men might be dangerous. So I'm just wondering if there's some similarities there. But I think, you know, your point is that there's a need for the therapist to be conscious of those power dynamics and to have an understand and to make it possible to talk about it, I suppose, and communicate that it's possible to talk about issues about power and how race may be part of that as well.
Yeah.
Rather than just expecting the person who's got relatively little power to feel strong enough to raise that as an issue in therapy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, this guy that I was talking about, Kenneth Hardy, he believes that a lot of trauma trainings do not actually address race enough. So even if you have a trauma, you know, you've gone through a trauma training, it doesn't necessarily equip you to work with some of the, you know, some of the racism that people might have experienced, which is an interesting concept. But he's not saying that, you know, you can't be this or you can't be. And he works with both people of color and people who are white. So, you know, that's also interesting.
Thanks. That's been really interesting. I think it's fantastic that we've been able to get into quite some detail about these, you know, really quite challenging areas.
Sure, you're welcome.
To move on, because I understand you've been most recently interested in compassionate inquiry training. Can you tell us a bit more about this work and what it entails?
Sure. I'll just give you a little bit of a history. So in 2018, I read a book called When the Body Says No by Gabor Maté. And this book made a significant impression upon me. And essentially, what the book really does is it talks about his experience as a physician with people who may be terminally ill or people who have very serious illnesses. And his conversations that he was having with these people. And then earlier this year, I came across his work again. And so that was when I was first introduced to Gabor Maté. And I was very interested to see that he developed a training called something called Compassionate Inquiry. And so he's a physician. He will put his hand up and say, I am not a trained anything in terms of therapy. He's a physician and he's got 20 years experience as a family practitioner. He's got also 12 years experience of working with people who are struggling with addictions and mental illness. And he has an interest in childhood development and so on. And he has come up with this approach, which is called compassionate inquiry. And I'll just read from the website because let me just see if I can find it. He says the purpose of compassionate inquiry is to drill down to the core stories people tell themselves, to get them to see what story they are telling themselves unconsciously, what those beliefs are, where they come from, and guide them to the possibility of letting go of those stories or letting go of the hold those stories have on them. And in a way, like Naomi and I met when we were doing training together in sensorimotor psychotherapy. What I've discovered about compassionate inquiry is it feels to me as if it just brings together all that I've learned through the sensorimotor psychotherapy, through my training in energy psychotherapy, through the polyvagal theory, all of these different things. It brings together all of these things in a very efficient way of processing trauma through embodiment. So, I was talking about body-based therapies earlier and we gave an example between David and myself. And so for me, all the principles and the approach and the interventions and everything, it was like what was missing from my attachment training. Because although the attachment training gave me a lot of theory and a lot of understanding about certain things, I really needed, in going to do the training, the sensory motor psychotherapy training, I really felt that I needed that additional support to really work with people and apply those theories, if you like. So for me, it really brings together all those things, and you're also working with parts. So it was like a refresher, but it also has aspects of the infant observation as well in practice. So it's like a kind of a tonic. And the work, it's super, super efficient, I find. And in the training, there's lots and lots of practice, weekly practice. So most of my work, because of course I'm doing my work, is whenever you do a training, I always use a training as an excuse to do my work in a way. So most of my work has actually focused on my very early attachment injuries. So the training is very intense, but the impact is quite profound.
Thank you. I love the way you've clearly got this very fertile and active mind that's always on the lookout to learn new things.
Thank you.
So most recently, I understand, you've specialised in working therapeutically with therapists. Do you think there's a great need for this? Is this something that's been overlooked, do you think?
You know, this is an interesting question. I remember Naomi and I were talking about it earlier this year. I wasn't consciously doing that, or thinking about a gap per se. One of the areas that I did invite, one of the groups that I invited when I was actually writing my website were trainees, people who were doing a training and who needed a therapist to support themselves through their own training. And then sometimes after the trainees qualify, they continue to do work, to work with me. And then other therapists just started to come. But, if my own experience or even some of my friends' experiences, my other professional friends, people who are therapists, or anything to go by, I have been in and out of therapy quite a bit. It feels like it's a really helpful support. We have supervision for sure. But I just know that there's something about working with this group of people, this cohort. I can't even put it into words. It's really lovely to work with this cohort of people, to be honest. And it's also a privilege in a way. And, you know, it's also helped me to, you know, to realize that I think there was a question, an earlier question about how, you know, there's a link to our own history and, you know, the therapeutic model of specialism that we choose. And it's only through working, you know, with people who are therapists, I've been able to notice that, yeah, so we can see why, you know, you've chosen to be a child psychotherapist or why you're doing, you know, a sort of ego and art movement therapy, you know. So, you know, it's just very fascinating. And it's very, very satisfying as well.
Thank you. And just to wind up at least this part of the conversation, and Naomi touched upon this earlier, I think. Do you think that people who are doing therapy or are offering therapy to others, should they all have had therapy themselves? And are there any particular risks or dangers if that isn't the case? What do you think?
The answer is yes, I do think so, but that's just my personal opinion. Dan Siegel talks about, he's a clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA, and he talks about nervous systems are connected bidirectionally. And you remember earlier on, I talked about how when someone experiences a trauma inside, what happens is sometimes their nervous system suffers a little deficit, particularly if it happens very early on. So when you're talking, as we are talking now, something is happening in your brain and in your nervous system as something is happening in mine. So the biology of one person affects another. And the more we have worked on ourselves as therapists, the more capacity we have to be with someone safely and to be able to hold their distress without our nervous system becoming dominated or taken over by them or this. So I think that people should at least have had an experience of it. But for me, because of the kind of work that I do, I also believe you can only take someone as far as where you've gone yourself. And that means that it's going to be a lifelong process. But I don't usually just do it because something's happened in therapy. Currently, why I'm doing it is because something's happening in my personal situation, my personal circumstances, and I'm wanting to explore my very, very early attachment injuries. So, you know, that, as I said, you know, that's just my personal opinion. And the dangers, as I've said before, can have quite serious consequences, you know, things like traumatizing and re-traumatizing clients, even to the point where, you know, it could be life-threatening. You know, what we're trying to do, you know, it's like, what are you trying to do as a, you know, before you even think about yourself as a therapist, is who are you as a person? And you need to understand that. And that's part of the work, right? And when I talk about the work, I mean, as having therapy, it's not just only understanding your traumas, but you need to understand who you are as a person and why you're in the helping profession.
That's a really useful observation. And I think also that information about Dan Siegel's observations about energy and how things are absorbed, because I think, you know, it's not unusual when you're working in services for people who got quite a lot of psychological disturbance themselves, for that to kind of bring out the disturbance in the staff group as well at the same time. And, you know, people who may well have functioned very well when practicing with clients who had less complex trauma, suddenly starting to behave in ways that seem quite crazy when working with a client group who've got a lot more trauma in their histories. But that was a brilliant conversation, Jennifer. Really insightful and lots of lovely. I loved you putting David on the spot with the
body-based experiment.
But you know, it's really nice to have someone who's applying therapeutic skills very actively on the podcast for a conversation. So thank you very much for so much of your time today.
Thank you. And there's just one more thing I wanted to say. It's just a circle back to what we talked about, Naima, when we were talking about it at the beginning of the year, when we were looking at well-being. And for me, if I think about what that looks like, it's about being able to have the increasing and expanding capacity for gratitude and awe and joy and love in our everyday living. And that's why, you know, working with broken attachment bonds and trauma, that interferes with our capacity to do that. So if we can nourish our nervous systems and nurture our nervous systems by doing that work, then we are increasing and expanding our capacity for these wonderful things in our lives. Thank you very much for having me.
So that was another very interesting conversation and a real pleasure meeting with Jennifer. I was particularly interested in the whole issue of phylogeny, and I think I've pronounced that correctly. Phylogeny, I've said it again. And because to me it kind of raised all those issues about transference and, you know, the way we really used to try and think about, well, how do people communicate things to each other, particularly on a kind of psychological level. And of course that also links up with, you know, a lot of the stuff that Jung was writing about in regards to the collective unconscious. So for me it was very interesting to see these ideas kind of floating back again.
Yeah, I really enjoyed having somebody on whose background isn't so much in forensics, but of course in trauma, which is so relevant to forensic practice. And I think Jennifer does a fantastic job of explaining things in a really straightforward, understandable way. So I'm hoping that people benefit from hearing that kind of like slightly deeper exploration of trauma than when we've made reference to it on occasion. And hopefully that will be useful for some of our listeners.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage lockeduplives.com and our Twitter account Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.